Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on our first case, 10-1373, State of Ohio versus Ashford Thompson. For the appellant, Ms. Troutman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, today I represent Ashford Thompson, the appellant, and I'm going to focus on proposition of law number one briefly, and then proposition of law number 17, and on this court's independent review under 2929.05A. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please. A threshold matter in this case is whether this court has jurisdiction at this time, whether there's a final appealable order. This court said in State versus Ketterer that there's a two-document rule in order to include the four requirements of Criminal Rule 32C. Those requirements are the fact of the conviction, the sentence, the judge's signature, and the stamp from the clerk of courts. The trial court in this case issued its journal entry and its 2929.03F opinion on June 23, 2010. In it, it stated that Ashford Thompson is sentenced to 5 years for the escape charge. The trial court issued its journal entry the next day. In it, it stated that Thompson is sentenced to 12 months for the same escape charge. The court issued a nunc-pro-tunc entry on July 1st. However, that entry did not include any of the correction for that sentence. There is a question as to how many journal entries there are actually in this case. The journal entry that was filed on June 24th, it was filed with two separate captions, although in the trial court's docket, they seem to be entered in the same transaction. So those are either two separate documents, or they are one whole document. If they are, in fact, one whole document, then all of the convictions and all of the sentences are accounted for when you take into account the 2929.03F opinion. However, there is still the issue of the sentence that is incorrect. Again, in one of those, Ashford Thompson was sentenced to 5 years for escape, and in the other, he was sentenced to 12 months. The appropriate sentence for that charge, the maximum sentence that he could have received for that escape charge, because it was an escape, it was a felony of the fifth degree, it was an escape for a misdemeanor, so the maximum charge he could have received was 12 months, which is what she gave him in her journal entry. However, in open court, she sentenced him to 5 years, and again, in her 2929.03F opinion, she also sentenced him to 5 years for that count.
So what are you saying, that the corrected journal entry is not valid?
At the very least, there's a confusion as to what sentence Ms. Ashford Thompson has received for the, it wasn't a corrected entry.
For the misdemeanor, for the escape charge.
It was not a corrected entry that she issued for the escape charge. The nunc-pro-tunc entry only corrected a date for the sentencing hearing. So that has never actually been corrected. So at the very least, this court should remand to the trial court, vacate the escape conviction so the trial court can sentence him according to the statute. If this court does find that it has jurisdiction and that the only requirement is to vacate the escape conviction and to remand back down to the trial court, then this court should also vacate the death sentence for Ashford Thompson. In this court's independent review, it is supposed to consider the offender, the offense, and it is supposed to consider whether this sentence is excessive or disproportionate to the other cases that are similar. Ashford Thompson made a very bad judgment call on July 13th, 2008. He was a man who was identified as a nurse, a caretaker, somebody who only had a concealed carry in order so that a licensed concealed carry so that he could bring his gun with him when he took care, when he did home health care in bad neighborhoods. This was not a man who had been convicted of anything violent. He was deeply religious and he was young and he was, again, he was a nurse, somebody who had dedicated himself to taking care of others. In 7 minutes, his life got out of control and Officer McTerrion was murdered. The trial court noted that this is not a case of prior calculation and design. This is not a man who set out to kill anyone. At 1:54 a.m. on July 13th, Officer McTerrion notified the police dispatch that he was conducting a traffic stop.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question along those lines. We're here on an independent weighing, and we're talking about the aggravating factors being weighed versus the mitigating factors. beyond a reasonable doubt, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the fact that the victim is a police officer to be given additional weight?
The fact that the police officer was the victim here is absolutely entitled to additional weight under, according to the legislature. That is why this became an aggravated murder. That is why he was indicted under 2903.01e, because the victim was a police officer. If he had not been a police officer, this would have been involuntary manslaughter or at most a murder. So yes, the fact that the victim was a police officer elevated it. However, the additional facts of this case, the fact that there was no prior calculation and design, the fact that that Ashford Thompson acted under duress, the trial court found that Daniel Roberson corroborated the fact that Ashford Thompson acted under duress. She was with Thompson when this occurred, and she spoke willingly to the detectives in the hours immediately following the murder. She described that she and Thompson were driving and singing songs, and she admitted that the music was too loud. When she asked if she knew why they were being pulled over, she told the detectives that we get stopped all the time in Twinsburg. The officer who pulled her over, Officer McTerrion, commented on the loud music, and Thompson started to retrieve his license. When the officer appeared to be alarmed, Ashford put up his hand, and she said he's just getting his license, and Ashford handed him his license. He had stood up out of the car. At that point, the officer asked him if he'd been drinking and told him that he needed to come and take a breathalyzer.
Counsel, I guess I'm trying to direct you more towards the facts beyond the fact that he's a police officer.
Yes,
you're arguing this morning duress.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the factual part that I'm having trouble with is it seems that the witness is suggesting the police officer may have been reaching for his gun, mm-hmm. and yet we have the defendant with a handcuff on one hand. How do we weigh that? It sounds to me like he was in the process of being arrested.
Yes, Your Honor. He was. What we must remember is this began with a noise ordinance violation, and it escalated from there. Yes, he was pushed down on the ground, he was handcuffed, and then he was pushed up against the car.
Was he handcuffed?
He had one handcuff, Your Honor, one handcuff. And this is what is described by Daniel Roberson. Ashford Thompson described the dog that is barking in the car, that is seemingly vicious, that has access to both the front and the back seat of the car, a dog that is later confirmed by Detective Klein during testimony during the trial that he was, in fact, a vicious dog. Hours after the murder, they had to bring in somebody special to come and get the dog out of the car. As soon as the dog was released from the car, he attacked that officer. But yes, Ashford Thompson believed that his life was in danger, that he was going to be in serious harm at the least.
Are you arguing that the circumstances of the stop and the traffic stop and the arrest was the duress? Is that what you're arguing?
No, I'm arguing that in Ashford Thompson's mind, he was pulled over for a noise ordinance violation, something that is not an arrestable offense, and all of a sudden he ended up on the hood of a police car, and he was handcuffed, and he saw the police officer reaching for what he thought was a gun. He reached for his taser. The fact that he reached for his taser has been confirmed by testimony from trial. The fact that the taser
was he resisting arrest?
He was convicted of resisting arrest, Your Honor, absolutely.
Okay, so the police officer is trying to cuff him, and he reaches for his taser.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so your client was resisting arrest, even if he believed that he should not have been arrested. I question whether he knew whether it was an arrestable offense or not, a noise violation. But he, rather than cooperate and sort the whole thing out, he ends up killing the police officer.
Which is exactly why he is convicted of aggravated murder, Your Honor, and not, there was no justifiable homicide found here. I would point out that
what?
Justifiable homicide argument that I'm making. He was, in fact, convicted.
Are you saying
arrested.
That this was self-defense?
No, I am saying that Ashford Thompson, the night this occurred, believed that he was going to be harmed. Whether that is a reasonable belief, whether we believe that he would have been harmed.
Well, you said that he thought the officer was reaching for a weapon.
Yes.
So are you arguing that your client was then justified in using as much force as is necessary to repel a deadly offense attack? Is that your argument?
My argument, no, Your Honor.
Confused
my
about
argument
what you're
is,
arguing to us.
My argument is the nature and the circumstances of the offense. My argument is what the trial court found, that Officer McTerrion, that Ashford Thompson believed that Officer McTerrion was going to harm him, whether that was right or wrong. And because of that belief, Ashford Thompson was acting under duress. This is not that Officer McTerrion was doing anything wrong. Ashford Thompson believed that he was. And at that moment—
Did he think the officer was going to do it or the dog?
At that moment, his unsworn statement to the court and to the victim's family, he discussed everything that was going through his mind. He discussed the fact that he was knocked down, that he was handcuffed, and that he was pushed on the car, and he could hear the dog barking, and the officer was telling him, I'm going to stick my dog on you, I'm going to put you in the car with my dog. So all of these things led to this belief and the decision, the bad decision that he made to pull
his handgun. Are you saying that he cooperated from the get-go and then all of a sudden started resisting? Because that's not what my understanding is.
The evidence that we have from Daniel Roberson is that he cooperated from the get-go. Immediately, he gave him his license and he offered his insurance card. That's corroborated by the fact that the officer, in fact, had Ashford's license. It was at that point, though, after that, that things escalated. Yes, Ashford has been convicted of resisting arrest. So, yes, we can assume from that point on that Ashford was not behaving in the manner that he should. However, again, Ashford believed that this officer was going to do him harm. Whether that is true or not, that was what was in his mind. And the trial court found that because of that, and because of Daniel Roberson's testimony, that there was duress.
So let me ask one follow-up question here. You started out by saying that his companion that evening said, we get stopped all the time in Twinsburg. Mm-hmm. So he's had experience with being pulled over before.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And he never reacted in this manner previously. So he knows that, you know, police officers are not there to do a roadside execution.
He knew that in his previous experiences, he had never been treated like this before. He had told, in his unsworn statement, he stated that this stop became different. It turned into a different scenario, obviously.
Counsel, this subjective argument that you're making, that it doesn't matter if he was right or wrong in his belief, if he says he believes he was threatened, that raises the issue of duress. Is that what you want us to say, that this is a subjective issue and not one of objective reasonableness?
The objective reasonableness test, I understand that that is what is applied when we consider a self-defense argument. Duress and mitigation is something that is much less than what is required to establish something like self-defense or duress as a legal defense. I am asking this court to consider what the trial court considered, and that is the testimony of Daniel Roberson and the statements of Ashford Thompson, in which she found that his belief was that the officer was reaching for a weapon, and that is why he pulled his trigger.
So you're saying that the belief of a defendant, or what they may argue is their belief after, after a conviction and for purposes of sentencing, you're saying if they say that they believed this, that should be taken into mitigation?
As long as there is some corroborating evidence, Your Honor. I'm not saying his word alone and his belief alone is what should be taken.
Well, this is his companion, the companion witness.
Also, the fact that the taser was out of the officer's pocket, that it was on the ground, that corroborates the fact that they both saw him reaching for what they believed was a gun, but in fact was a taser. Also, the fact that the dog was very aggressive, that corroborated what he was saying. So yes, there are factors that corroborate what he was saying. Even if we take out of consideration all of the duress, the factors that remain with Ashford Thompson still, I believe, should lead this court to the conclusion that he is not warranting of a death sentence. This is not, again, a case of prior calculation and design. He did not set out to kill somebody that night. And this is not a man who was violent, who had ever been convicted of something violent before.
You're not suggesting that the only time that the death penalty is warranted is where there's prior calculation and design, are you?
No. However, in the cases in which this court has found that more than prior calculation and design is required, there is also the fact that he is the principal offender and a felony. And the felony here would not have taken place had this not actually been a
police
officer.
But he was the principal offender. He's the principal offender, and the aggravated circumstance here is the killing of a police officer. You would agree with that?
The aggravating circumstance and the aggravated murder are identical. There is nothing that elevates it past that. Yes. There are other cases in which the defendant had been convicted of killing a police officer and sentenced to death, and as those cases to which this court should compare Ashford Thompson. The other cases with the A6 specification. Such cases, and the only case out of this court's A6 case law in which there was no prior calculation in design is State versus Queasy Bryan. In State versus Queasy Bryan, he was also, however, convicted of a course of conduct specification because he attempted to shoot somebody else. In addition, Mr. Bryan, this court found, had outstanding warrants for theft and receiving stolen property and violating parole. He also, according to this court, supported himself by dealing drugs and robbing drug dealers. This stands in stark contrast to Ashford Thompson, who had dedicated his life to healing people. He became a nurse and did home health care, and again, the only reason he even had a weapon on him that night was in order to, because the jobs he performed were in bad neighborhoods, and he had no way to protect himself. Another case to which this court should compare this case is State versus Jones. Mr. Jones was convicted of prior calculation and design. Because he was facing a lot of time for robbery, he ended up shooting the police officer. The officer that approached him saying, "I don't want no problem, I'm just doing my job." And at that point, he ran away, turned around, shot the police officer, kicked him, and then continued. This court found nothing that was mitigating in the nature and the circumstances of the offense.
Counsel, what the mitigation hearing here, what evidence was presented? Can you go into that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The evidence that was considered by the trial court is the duress that I mentioned, also the fact that Ashford Thompson was relatively young, he was 23, which she only gave slight weight to. However, the trial court gave significant weight to the testimony of the friends and family that testified on Ashford Thompson's behalf. Ashford was known as the person who members of the neighborhood could call if they needed something. For example, there was the testimony of a woman named Stephanie Pounds. She was a friend of the family. The defendant was there for her when her son died, and when her car broke down in the middle of the winter, he came and got her and her kids. There was also the testimony of a woman named Rodette Dixon. The defendant took care of her brother, who was in a vegetative state. She testified that Ashford Thompson was one of the better nurses that she'd seen. He bathed and fed and changed the diaper of her brother. The family members of Ashford Thompson testified. Ashford is a very religious, deeply religious man, and he would teach children about the Bible. All of these things are things that the court took into consideration in the nature and the character and the history and the background of Mr. Thompson.
Was there a prior criminal record?
The prior criminal record that Ashford Thompson had consisted of traffic offenses, a noise ordinance violation, and a properly controlling his vehicle. He was not a violent person. This court and other cases has done in its independent review has come to the conclusion that others did not warrant a sentence of death. The most recent case is State versus Tenace. Mr. Tenace had had two trials and was sentenced twice by two juries to death, yet this court found that in its independent review he did not deserve the death penalty. Mr. Tenace was convicted of stomping on the head and strangling his victim, pulling the telephone cord out of the wall and leaving him to die. This was a victim who was elderly, who Mr. Tenace had identified because he had worked on a chimney for him and learned that he had cash on hand.
Doesn't your argument, however, have some difficulty with the facts of the case that the officer was shot four times in the head?
Your Honor, the fact that the officer was shot four times in the head indicates the amount of panic that Ashford Thompson had. This was not a cold and calculated pull the trigger once and walk away. This is a man who unloaded his gun and then took off. This was not somebody who, again, had done anything violent in the past, and this was something that he panicked and everything went wrong. But because of the man that he is, because of the man that he was the day before that, he does not warrant the death sentence. This is not somebody who is a danger.
So let me just understand. You're proposing that Mr. Thompson had a normal evening with his girlfriend. No incidents in the bar, because there's testimony otherwise. There's testimony that he was highly agitated and threatening in the bar. Is that correct?
There is one witness who testified that he was not threatening, that he was making statements to his girlfriend along the lines of, they don't know what I'm capable of or what I've done. I would submit that his record alone would contradict that. He hasn't done anything.
Well, that he, you know, what he was talking about is speculative, of course, but... Then there was a discovery, I think, of there was an alcohol bottle, a broken bottle at his residence, as well as...
Which is...
Go ahead.
Which is actually, Your Honor, something that we've raised as misconduct. The alcohol bottle was not related to him in any way. It didn't have his DNA. It wasn't even the type of beer that he drank. Yet the picture of it was introduced into evidence as some sort of indication that he had something to do with this broken alcohol bottle. And it was in no way connected to this case or to Mr. Thompson. The witness that you're referring to, Mr. Bartz, his testimony was contradicted by the bartender who testified, who was also there. The music was not loud, and he didn't hear anything of that nature from Mr. Thompson. The trial court didn't seem to give that much weight. She didn't take that into consideration or mention it at all in her opinion, in which she determined whether he was sentenced to death. In this court's case law, it is also in two other cases, State versus Claydor and State versus Lawrence, found that the individual, despite his crime, was not worthy of the death sentence. In State versus Lawrence, he killed two people and tried to kill two more by shooting them with a shotgun. The murder victims were a married couple, and he shot the husband and brought the wife over, laid her across her husband, and then shot her with a shotgun. However, this court found that there was some provocation because of the fact that the victims were inciting him by having a loud party and verbally abusing him. There was also, to some extent, he had the B3 factor, a little bit of mental disease and defect, and the court determined that his devotion to and the care for his late mother and his voluntary military service, which, as the dissent pointed out, consisted of simply a month and no combat, he had a deep love and caring for his children, and these were the redeeming traits that made him worthy of a life sentence.
Counsel, the circumstance of killing to escape detection under A3, wasn't that an issue in this case as well?
Yes, Your Honor. For one thing, it was a noise ordinance violation for which he was initially pulled over. The facts that support that conviction are confusing for me because the escape he was convicted of was he was convicted of an escape for a misdemeanor. However, the A3 specification requires the purpose that you are purposely killing something for the purpose of escaping an underlying offense for which you have committed. He has to be guilty of that underlying offense. He has been convicted of felonies. However, when you look at the arraignment and the indictment, there's a laundry list of things for which they're referring to the offense that he'd committed. They claim maybe it was the concealed carry, maybe it was the noise ordinance violation, maybe it was the OVI, maybe it was resisting arrest. He was never convicted of the noise ordinance violation or an OVI, so I'm assuming, not because that there's anything that shows that, but he was convicted of resisting arrest and concealed carry. But yes, that is another specification for which he was convicted.
So there were two specifications, not just the killing of the police officer. We have two convictions that the jury found.
Much like the other cases in which this court has found that under the independent review that the individual did not deserve a sentence of death. And when you compare his case to other A3 specifications, murder to escape detection, he also does not compare. His case is very different from these other individuals to which this court has found that a death sentence is warranted. First, for example, in State versus Lawson, that is a case in which this court found that the A3 specification existed and determined a sentence of death. He had kidnapped his victim and killed him to prevent his testimony to avoid conviction for a burglary.
Do you have a case that has both convictions where the independent review was not a death sentence?
There is no case in this court's case law in which there was an A6 specification, the killing of a police officer, and this court has found that the individual did not deserve a death sentence. However, this court's case law in which it determines that the individual does not deserve a death sentence has no consistent factors. This is not a simple, there is not one death specification that this court has determined is less than the others, there are a variety of circumstances in all three of the cases in which this court has found that in its independent review the individual deserved life. There are varying factors that this court considered.
But we've not reversed a death penalty for both of these specifications in the past.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thompson's life showed an overwhelming desire to help people with what he did growing up, with the kind of person that he was before the night of July 13th, 2008. That and the lack of the prior calculation and design demonstrate that the sentence imposed upon him is wrong. What he did on that night has resulted in his conviction. That is what elevated the fact that it was a police officer, elevated it to an aggravated murder. But who he was, the good person inside him, and everything he did before that horrible decision makes him worthy of a life sentence. And if this court has no further questions, I'm going to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Cassay.
Thank you. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Richard Cassay representing the state of Ohio in this case. Concerning the jurisdictional issue, whether or not there's a final order, there are four entries at play here. The first one, and I'm going to talk about them in chronological order, although they are not filed on separate chronologically distinct days. June 24th, 2010, there's an entry that announces the several verdicts and indicates that there was a Rule 29 on count three, which was the felony three escape charge. So that count is out. It sets the mitigation hearing for June 10th of 2010. Then we come to the sentencing opinion pursuant to 29-2903F. And this opinion incorrectly sentences Mr. Thompson to 5 years on merged counts three and four, three being the count that had been Rule 29, four being the fifth-degree felony count of escape. So that sentences Mr. Thompson to 5 years. Then we come to what I'm going to refer to as the sentencing entry or the judgment of conviction. And this is filed June 24th, 2010 also. This entry, in the state's view, is a complete and final order. It contains both the fact of the convictions and the manner. It contains sentences. It is signed by a judge, and there is a timestamp. Significantly, this sentencing entry does not mention count three. Instead, a sentence is imposed correctly on count four for 12 months. Then we come to this nunc pro tunc entry, and the argument here is, from Mr. Thompson, is that this nunc pro tunc entry has to be in and of itself a final order with all the Lester requirements contained in it. What this nunc pro tunc entry does is go back and correct the entry entry which formerly stated that the sentencing hearing would commence on June of 2006. Instead, it corrects the date to 2010. And that's all that it does.
So it doesn't correct the mistake in the second entry referring to count three?
The sentencing entry? No.
Okay.
Now that the real issue here, well, there's two issues. What is the function of a nunc pro tunc entry? This court has made it clear time and time and time again that a nunc pro tunc entry is properly used to correct a clerical mistake. When a former entry says that a hearing commenced in 2006, when it's plain to everyone who thinks about it that the year was 2010, that is a clerical, mechanical mistake. Has nothing to do with, in the words of Ketterer or the cases it cites, it has nothing to do with a legal determination or any kind of judgment. That is a proper nunk-pro-tunk entry. Now, does it have to, then the sub-issue is, does this nunk-pro-tunk entry have to contain all the Lester requirements? The state is not aware of any case saying that it must, because, and that makes sense, because what is the function of the nunk-pro-tunk entry? Correcting clerical mistakes. When it does that, it has fulfilled its mission, its task is complete, there's no reason for it to go further. Surely, and I'm not disputing, that these entries commonly will repeat the text of the entry being corrected, but there is no requirement that it do so.
Mr. Cassay, you're saying that the third entry was the final appealable order, and that was fine. But my question is, you said the second order had a mistake in it because it referred to a count that had been dismissed under Rule 29.
Right.
So the concern or the question I have is, you've got a nunk-pro-tunk that's correcting something in the first entry, but there's a second entry with a mistake in it. Is that a problem or is that not a problem because the third entry did not refer to count three at all in the sentence, correct?
Yes. There is a conflict, and you know, it can't be denied that in the sentencing opinion pursuant to 2929.03F sentences Mr. Thompson on account that had been dismissed pursuant to Rule 29. Again, that error is not brought over into what I'm referring to as the sentencing entry that the nunk-pro-tunk entry corrects. Is the conflict such that we don't have a final order? The state's position is no, because when you look at 2929.03, that statute is titled Imposition of Sentence for Aggravated Murder. There's not one word in it concerning sentencing ranges or consideration or anything else concerning classified felonies.
Counsel, can I move you to a new subject?
You may, of course.
It seems that we're here today to talk about weighing in a very tragic case.
Yes.
Police officer is dead. State of Ohio would like to execute the defendant. The opposing counsel suggests that the critical element here is duress. It seems to me from my reading of the record that the mitigation is very clear here, that this is a nice young man who played varsity sports, put himself through nursing school, was carrying a gun because he was doing nursing in bad neighborhoods. Can you explain to me why the trial court did not seem to address the issue of duress? My understanding is he ended up with a handcuff on one hand. There's no question there was a struggle. There's no question that the police officer was threatening him with both weapons and a dog. And I'm just wondering, how do we get past the subjective statement by the defendant that he thought the cop was taking him in and he was in fear for his life? How do we get past that?
Well, several reasons, Your Honor. This court has defined duress in the context of the mitigating circumstance as something that a defendant is compelled or forced to do. So let's ask ourselves, what compelled or forced Ashford Thompson to shoot Officer McTarion four times in the head? The dog just comes to mind. The evidence was, coming from Daniel Roberson or Mr. Thompson, that he felt threatened by the dog. But according to Roberson, the officer did not say, "I'm letting this dog out on you." What she testified to was the officer said, if you do not behave or if you give me a problem, I might let the dog out. The officer...
Didn't he actually say that I will put you in the police car with the dog?
That may have been in Thompson's unsworn statement. It was not in Roberson's testimony.
But isn't that to be weighed by this court this morning when determining whether or not duress was in play?
Well, the function of this court, my understanding, is that you consider it, but you do not have to accept it.
No, I understand that.
Right. There was an exchange prior that because the defendant says something, how much credibility does this court have to give it? Well, that's up to this court. That's why your function is to perform an independent way.
Can you concede this morning that it was a wrongful arrest?
No.
Can someone be arrested for a boombox in their car?
No, but the other factor that's at play here is that there was testimony that Mr. Thompson was drunk at 11:30 p.m. Going on into this incident happened right close to 2 a.m. At 11:30, he's seen at a bar drunk and makes a statement, I will kill if some MFer threatens me. So this is his state of mind going into the ensuing hours. There was one cuff on Ashford Thompson's wrist when he was discovered. So the inference has to be that this officer was arresting him at that time. For what? DUI, that is the most probable or most likely occurrence. We don't know what the officer's mind, but from the evidence, that is the most likely inference why Thompson was cuffed. Now, the nature and circumstances of the offense are not aggravators, but they can be viewed to see if there's any mitigating evidence in them. Here, there simply isn't. No rational argument could be made that there's anything mitigating in the nature and circumstance of this offense. What the trial court found mitigating to some extent was a lack of significant criminal history. Does that make a difference? The state's position, obviously, is it does not.
Well, counsel, now we're into what I personally have struggled with, and I've watched others on this court struggle with, and former Chief Justice Tom Moyer and I used to engage on the very question that you touched on. You said that his lack of criminal history would you include in that his military service, the fact that he's a nurse, those kind of things don't count for much in mitigation?
I'm not saying they don't count for anything.
Because we've had this discussion, should it be mitigating that one had a lousy childhood, abusive parents, in all kinds of in and out of institutions as a youth? Would that be mitigating, or would it be more mitigating that one brought up in the same neighborhood, stayed out of trouble, served his country, went to church, had a profession?
Is it more mitigating?
How would you tell us to assess those things? Because it's what we're required to do under the statute.
Well, one part of that issue is it more mitigating to have a bad childhood, or is it more mitigating to have a good childhood?
Yeah.
Obviously, I cannot give you a categorical answer on that question. Individual justices are going to reach their own conclusions in each specific case. The facts of each case have to be looked at in one case it may be, the justice may consider it to be mitigating. In another case, you may not. So it's an issue that you, Justice Pfeiffer, obviously have struggled with over the years. But if you're looking to me for an answer, I'm sorry. I wish I could give it to you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Cassay, remind me in terms of the timing. Was the jury allowed to consider a sentence of life without parole in this case? Was this? We know that the timing of the statute, the change that allows life without parole, was that something the jury here could have considered?
I can't. I confess that I can't answer you categorically. My impression is yes, but I do not. I cannot categorically tell you yes, Your Honor. I believe so.
Counsel, what about the fact that the trial court gave little or no weight to remorse? It seems to me that the remorse of the defendant is very clear here, and the trial court said, well, yeah, but he fled the scene, so therefore there is no remorse, and I'm having trouble with that.
Well, that was the trial court's reasoning. Mr. Thompson did express remorse in his unsworn statement. The trial court's evaluation of that, leading to the court's conclusion that it was entitled to little, if any, weight, was the fleeing after murdering the officer, going to the family member's home, and again, this is not an aggravator, but it's the facts and circumstances. At that home, struggling to the extent that a door hat was ripped off a refrigerator, trying to subdue him. So, you know, he was intent on fleeing from that incident. So in the trial court's mind, and I think reasonably, his expression of remorse, when you look at his actions, is maybe not as sincere as some people would have you believe. So I think that would be the state's view of that, Your Honor. Now, I did want to address a question from you, Justice O'Neill. Is the fact that a police officer was killed, is that entitled to additional weight? I think there are two components to that. A police officer is one of the few actual identifiable persons or category of persons that the death penalty specifications list. You have the President of the United States, the Vice President, the Governor of Ohio, the Lieutenant Governor, a child under 13, or a police officer. So in that sense, it's important. In another sense, is it more important than a police officer is killed than a woman is the victim of an aggravated murder during the course of a rape? No, in that sense it isn't, because that is another specification that, if proved at the trial and at the mitigation.
That was the purpose of my question. You've framed it better than I did.
I have more time to think about it. Thank you.
Well, very good. But the reality is that the victim being a police officer, tragic as it is an element of the crime. And can it be an element of the crime and an aggravating factor together?
Well, that's the narrowing question going to the Zant case. And the consistent holdings have been that, yes, as counterintuitive as some people might argue it to be, the specification, the narrowing specification, can repeat the element of the offense. That's been the consistent holding of this court. It's been the consistent holding of the United States Supreme Court. So the state is going to rely on those cases.
Does the officer have to be in the line of duty?
Yes.
So that's part of the, would you consider that the element or the aggravating factor?
I believe that's an element in the statute. And the defendant has to know that, obviously that's present here. Um, The argument is that this is a law-abiding, religious, mild-mannered, peaceful nurse. And maybe before that night he was. But he didn't act in character. And there's evidence that what was going on in Mr. Thompson's psyche was not what others perceived him to have. And that evidence is his actions and statements at the bar. Again, that's not an aggravator, but you know the court has to look at that, I believe, in the weighing against the mitigating circumstances.
Wasn't the testimony from the girlfriend he had had one half of one beer at the bar?
Well, that's a credibility determination. Yeah,
I understand, but yes. Wasn't that the testimony?
They all have half a beer, or they had a few. Mr. Thompson had half a beer. The witness who was not related or had no discernible bias said he was drunk. So that's...
There was also testimony that he was agitated in the bar.
Yes, he was threatening and loud to the...
Then there was also, I believe, a phone conversation where he admitted, and this was after the arrest, that he was agitated that evening because his girlfriend wasn't ready when he wanted to go out.
That was the state's rebuttal evidence at the guilt phase. They played a phone conversation indicating that Mr. Thompson was upset, annoyed that Danielle Robertson, the prior day in the evening, came out of the house dressed in a fashion that Mr. Thompson apparently thought was too risque or did not meet his standards, and he was upset by that. So he's starting off the evening upset, annoyed, a bit angry. Yes, that was in evidence, Your Honor. Reaching for the gun. Again, this is not an aggravator. But what was Officer McTarion doing? The only thing that was off the officer's duty belt was his taser, found on the ground, not discharged. He was reaching for his gun. That's what Mr. Thompson's attorneys want you to believe. We don't know that. The officer had another set of handcuffs back here around his back and could just as likely have been reaching for those. We don't know, and we're never going to know. But to come to or jump to the conclusion that the officer was reaching for his gun is speculative and not something that requires. The evidence is not such that this court is required to believe that.
But my understanding was that while he was trying to subdue him on the front of the car, and apparently must have gotten one half of the handcuff on his wrist, presumably behind his back, the officer then reached for his taser in order to complete the arrest. Is that not what transpired? Based on the evidence of the taser being out of, his belt and on the floor?
It is possible that the officer was reaching for the taser because the taser was found on the ground. So, sure, that is a possibility, and if it's the correct possibility, that taser was never employed. How the taser got on the ground, again, it's something that I don't know, and I venture to say nobody else is going to know. But it was on the ground. So, yes, he could have been reaching for the taser.
Counsel, I want to take you in a completely different direction, if I can.
Sure.
And that has to do with the Batson challenge. The issue was Juror 6. Can you address that?
Yes. The primary basis of the state's peremptory challenge was its belief, and a belief fortified by that prospective juror's own statements and facial expressions was that she was the holdout, the lone holdout in a prior criminal case. It was some time ago, but that she was the lone holdout. Now, when the state indicated its desire to challenge that particular juror, defense counsel, as is apparently the standard practice nowadays, says Batson, period. I have a Batson challenge, without any attempt to show that the state's intent to discharge this particular juror was racially motivated. Now, the state didn't object when defense counsel did that. That does not mean that the state agrees that this is the proper procedure, that defense counsel can get out the word Batson and then we're just into step two of the analysis, but it's a waiver. You know, I admit the state waived that issue. Then the court or the prosecutor talked about his belief that she was the lone holdout. Another prosecutor gave another reason that she was, this particular prospective juror was related to a person in the sheriff's office, and at the sheriff's office that relative was exposed to talk about all sorts of things, including pending cases. But the other prosecutor came back with, the real reason is she was a holdout. Now, Mr. Thompson's attorneys are telling you, Your Honor, that the trial court just didn't do what it should have done. It did not inquire. But the trial court did inquire. It inquired to the extent that it said, I don't think that's good enough. And then there was more dialogue and more questioning, and the trial court has to be the inference that at some point the trial court knew that the state had an honest belief that this was grounds to remove the juror. And then the trial court granted the challenge. The test on review, their burden to prove racial discrimination, clearly erroneous. Important factor is the credibility of the prosecutor. The trial court did that. You know, to me, it's obvious from the record that the trial court was doing that. When the court questioned the prosecutor at length and had to be convinced, if that's the word, that really the prosecutor meant this. Now, this is a peremptory challenge, even though in certain situations it has to be justified. But it's still a peremptory challenge. It does not matter if me or this court or any other court thinks it's a good reason. The U.S. Supreme Court has said the reason doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be plausible. What it has to be is racially neutral.
Counsel, I guess what Justice French is asking, though, is the opposing counsel, I'm reading from the trial court right now, trial court said that's a race-neutral reason.
Yes.
And your opposing counsel is suggesting that's not good enough, that the trial court has to then say, and I believe it.
I believe it. No, that's. I don't think there's a requirement the trial court has to. If the trial court finds it's a race-neutrally reason, I think that's evidence that the trial court believes it's a racially neutral reason.
But the language.
If that's the question, I may not be catching it.
Okay. I'm looking at Rice versus White out of the Sixth Circuit, and there I think that I think is the biggest hurdle. Is that in Rice, it says that the trial judge has to clearly retract early statements that a race-neutral reason lacks credibility. And here it appears that we had the trial court saying, I'm not buying that, and then later does change her mind. So do we have to worry about what Rice versus White says out of the Sixth Circuit?
Well, it's certainly persuasive, but are a trial court court's or anybody else's actions provable by what they say or what they do, or do they have to recite magic words? That's apparently what that particular panel, and I don't know if that was an in-bank opinion. I'm pretty sure that it probably wasn't. Does a trial court have to say these talismanic words? Well, that may be the Sixth Circuit's opinion. I don't know that the United States Supreme Court has gone that far. But the state's position would be, if when you looked at this record, the trial court became convinced of the state's that this is what we honestly believe.
Well, counsel, doesn't the trial court say, I'm not buying it that she works for the sheriff's office as a reason for the prosecution to excuse her at all? That's what she's not buying. And then she goes on to say, you know, the real reason is that she was a holdout in a former juror, or in a former jury. Although she didn't say, I was the holdout, the prosecutor was firmly of the belief that she was the holdout and used that as the basis for not wanting her on the jury, which is a race-neutral reason.
I'm sure that was the court's ultimate conclusion. Yes, I agree with you, Your Honor.
An African-American.
Excuse me?
Previously, there was seated an African-American on the jury.
There were two African-Americans on the panel and one non-Caucasian among the alternates. That again, is evidence of the state's lack of intent to purge the jury of somebody who isn't white. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Cassay, with the facts and the circumstances involving this situation, Officer McTerrion was not African American, correct?
He was not.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you.
Counsel, you've reserved about 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. To begin with Justice French's question, the Batson claim, there is a Supreme Court case. I would direct this court to Snyder versus Louisiana, a case that I supplemented last week as additional authority. In that case, the Supreme Court noted the importance of a trial court's finding and the determination of the demeanor, both of the prosecutor and of the juror himself. The trial court's statements to the prosecutor, I'm not buying that, when the prosecutor offered that as a race-neutral reason, and told him that my concern is that if you really thought that was a problem, you should have inquired of that juror. I think those are indications of the prosecutor's, or the trial court's determination of the prosecutor's
demeanor.
Wait a minute,
there's two reasons here that are being proffered by the prosecutor. One, she was the holdout on a prior criminal jury, mm-hmm. and two, she works at the sheriff's office and has, you know, all kinds of information, and the court says, I'm not buying that she works for the sheriff's office as a reason for the prosecution to excuse her at all. And so that's put to rest.
She also said that according to about the other reason on page 1131.
But she says then that she accepts that the reason is race neutral as to her performance on a prior jury. And when that is coupled with the fact that there were African Americans seated on the jury, how do you prevail on a Batson challenge?
Well, as an initial matter, I don't believe the fact that there had been another African American seated on the jury takes away the problem with this particular Batson claim. But the prosecutor then, after the court told it didn't believe it, he offered another reason. Then the trial court said, I don't believe that reason. So he went back to the first reason. At that point, yes, the trial court said, well, you've offered a race-neutral reason. She didn't say she believed it. And then she said, because this is the first one, and because there are African-Americans, other African-Americans on the jury, we will move on. But there again, the prosecutor said that the juror kind of smiled like she was the holdout. The trial court made no determination about that portion of the juror's demeanor. And according to Snyder versus Louisiana, that is important. Therefore, like in Snyder, this court can't presume that the trial court credited the prosecutor's assertions about the juror's demeanor.
But counsel, isn't the Batson remedy created to avoid prosecutors removing jurors solely on the basis of race.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the whole idea that Batson came about, to remedy that situation. So the fact that this was not a situation where the court found the prosecutor was intentionally removing people on basis of race, I mean, that takes it out of Snyder versus Louisiana, doesn't it?
No, I don't believe it does. For one thing, the prosecutor or the trial court, Snyder versus Louisiana was about the trial court giving weight to the demeanor of the prosecutor and also to the juror's demeanor, because that is what the prosecutor said. The juror smiled like she was the holdout. The trial court at no point addressed that. At no point did she give any weight to the juror's demeanor as being the holdout. In fact, all she had done is question the prosecutor's statements as to that effect. I would like to address just a few things since my time is running out. I point this court to the prosecutor's statements to the jury during closing argument, when the prosecutor led the jury to believe that in order to find Ashford Thompson was a good person, that they would have to believe that Officer Thompson did something wrong. That's not the case. This court can find that Ashford Thompson, in the person that he was before, the person that he is inside, despite the fact that he made a horrible mistake, is still worthy of living. Also, I would point this court to the fact that Daniel Roberson testified that she feared for the defendant's life because she saw the officer reach for his taser and she thought it was a gun. This is not just Ashford Thompson testifying or making an unsworn statement about the dog in the car or his own thoughts. And despite the fact that she was his girlfriend, she was speaking to the detectives hours after this murder. She had no reason, had never been in this type of a situation before, and no reason to lie for him, and didn't. In fact, she even told the officers how she grabbed the gun out of the car, held it in a towel because she didn't want to get any fingerprints on it, and this was his thing. This was not hers. He did something wrong, and she wasn't going to get involved. The testimony at trial was not that he was drunk. There was some testimony from Bartz that he was acting agitated, but the actual testimony from the bartender was that he had a half a beer. There was no testimony that when the officer called in, there was nothing about swerving. He pulled him over for a noise ordinance violation. And this court cannot forget the role that race had to have played in this case. Ashford Thompson was a 23-year-old black male, and he killed a white police officer. The thoughts that he had in his mind were because of the experiences that he has had. He was pulled over for a noise ordinance violation and ended up on the hood of a car with a handcuff on his wrist.
What area of, was it a residential area that this occurred? So this is 2 a.m. in the morning.
He was home.
With loud music, right?
He was driving on a street, turned into his residential area, yes. He was pulled over. The officer pulled in the driveway behind him. According to Thompson, the officer didn't believe that he actually lived there. And the point that he began resisting arrest, even if he was agitated beforehand, he gave the officer his license. He gave the officer his insurance card. He did not begin all of this with the intent to cause any harm to anybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.